From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
These individuals wish to wage a quote, full ground war against the United States. That quote is from the investigation of these individuals who also allegedly stated the desire to, quote, kill all the devils we can. They hoped for their attacks to be, quote, just as good or greater than 9/11.
The Bush administration has made hundreds of arrests in the so-called war on terror. Very few have resulted in terrorist convictions. What's the significance of the seven people arrested in Miami last week? Then organizer Nativa Lopez on the immigration bill and the future of the immigrants' rights movement.
The GOP is setting up a situation, a dynamic that will only lead to further social disorder or civil strife and possible social revolution in Mexico or other southern countries.
And the 2006 World Cup is underway in Germany.
This is the time of year when soccer fans across the United States get to leave their sports witness protection program and rejoice in the most watched sporting event in the world, the World Cup. But the tournament this year has not been without controversy, both with regards to issues of race, militarism, and immigration. All of these issues have come to fore this year in the 2006 World Cup.
Sports writer Dave Zirin. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration and leading Republicans are lashing out at the New York Times and other media outlets for their reports on the government's secret monitoring of international bank transactions without court approval. This is U.S. Treasury Secretary John Snow.
This is a great disappointment to me. I got to say that. I got to be honest with you. This is regrettable. We tried to dissuade people from running these stories. As you know, what the disclosures do is fundamentally undermine an important source of information, make that source of information less useful. And again, let me say the only beneficiaries of that are the terrorists. It only helps the terrorists. So it's very regrettable.
Meanwhile, the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee is calling for the prosecution of all New York Times staff members who are involved in exposing the financial spying. In an interview with Fox News Sunday, New York Republican Congressmember Peter King said the New York Times should be prosecuted for violating the Espionage Act. Critics, meanwhile, say the financial spying echoes the Bush administration's wiretapping of Americans without court warrant. This is Democratic Congressmember Ed Markey of Massachusetts.
Like the domestic surveillance program exposed last December, the Bush administration's efforts to tap into the financial records of thousands of Americans appears to rely on justifications concocted without regard to current law or constitutional protections.
In Iraq, an insurgent group has released video footage showing the killing of three kidnapped Russian embassy workers. Two of the hostages are beheaded in the video, while a third is shot. A fourth Russian hostage is also believed to have been killed. The workers were abducted in Baghdad earlier this month. An investigation carried out by the Los Angeles Times has concluded at least 50,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed since the start of the Iraq War. The number is equivalent to the killing of some 570,000 Americans over the same period. Other studies have put the toll far higher. In 2004, a Johns Hopkins Columbia University study published in the British medical journal The Lancet estimated the Iraqi civilian death toll at over 100,000 people. That number was considered conservative because it excluded the toll in Fallujah, one of the hardest-hit cities of the invasion. The Los Angeles Times estimate was based on statistics from the Baghdad Morgue, the Iraqi Health Ministry, and other agencies. Their figure is at least 20,000 more than the Bush administration has publicly acknowledged. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has announced 350 innocent Iraqis were killed at U.S. checkpoints last year, an average of at least six killings per week. A senior intelligence official told Reuters that out of a total of 4,000 incidents in which U.S. troops responded to a perceived threat, less than 2% were later found to have posed an actual threat. In other Iraq news, two National Guard members have been charged in connection with the February shooting of an unarmed Iraqi near the town of Ramadi. The Guard members are currently being held in Baghdad, where they'll face pretrial hearings. And also in Iraq, the government has announced an offer to grant amnesty to insurgent groups. The amnesty would not apply to those who have killed Iraqis or U.S. troops. The proposal is part of a national reconciliation plan drawn up with close consultation with U.S. political and military leaders. Despite prior speculation, the plan does not include a timetable for the withdrawal of foreign troops. In Israel, the government is promising a harsh response to a Palestinian incursion that killed two Israeli soldiers and kidnapped a third. The militants spent weeks digging a tunnel from the Gaza Strip into Israel before launching the attack. Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri called the raid a response to recent Israeli strikes that have killed Palestinian civilians and leaders in the Gaza Strip.
This heroic operation that took place early this morning north of the Gaza Strip represents a normal retaliation on the continuous targeting of Palestinian civilians amid the cries of the child Huda Ghalia and in front of the killing of the two leaders, Al-Kuka and Abu Samha Dena. Under the continuous escalations, the resistance and its operations will continue to defend our Palestinian people.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the Hamas operation, saying it would lead to further Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said he holds Abbas directly responsible.
The State of Israel sees the Palestinian Authority, headed by Chairman Abu Mazen, responsible for this incident, with everything that implies.
In East Timor, Prime Minister Muri Alkatiri announced today he's ready to step down. Alkatiri has been blamed for weeks of unrest following his decision to dismiss thousands of troops from the military. Alkatiri said he's resigning to avoid the departure of President Sinani Gusmao. Gusmao threatened to quit unless Alkatiri left office. In Sri Lanka, a suicide bombing killed a top military general and three others earlier today. The government immediately blamed the rebel Tamil Tigers. The slain general was Sri Lanka's third highest-ranking military officer. In Somalia, a Swedish journalist was killed Friday while covering a rally in Mogadishu. The cameraman, Martin Adler, had won awards for his work in countries including Iraq and China. His death marked at least the 10th slaying of a foreign journalist in Somalia in the last 15 years. The Islamic Courts Union, which now controls Mogadishu, blamed the killing on an opposition warlord. In Pakistan, media and human rights groups are calling for an independent inquiry into the abduction and killing of journalist Hayatullah Khan. Khan's body was discovered earlier this month, 6 months after he was abducted in Waziristan. He was found handcuffed and gunshot wounds in his back. Khan's family has blamed Pakistan's intelligence service for his disappearance. In December, he unearthed evidence that a wanted militant had been killed by a CIA missile, contradicting the government's claim the militant accidentally blew himself up with explosives. Khan was kidnapped shortly after making his story public. In other news, the Sudanese government has suspended the United Nations mission in Darfur. The suspension will apply to all UN agencies except UNICEF and the World Food Program. The Sudanese government says it acted after learning a UN helicopter had transported a Darfurian rebel leader who rejects a recently signed peace agreement. Back in the United States, an FBI official announced Friday the alleged plot by seven Miami terror suspects was, quote, more aspirational than operational and posed, quote, no immediate threat. The suspects were apprehended last week without any weapons or explosives. The government maintains they were planning to attack the Sears Tower in Chicago and FBI buildings around the country. We'll have more on this after headlines. New details have emerged from the investigation into the activities of indicted Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. According to a Senate report released last week, a group headed by prominent right-wing activist Grover Norquist was one of several tax-exempt organizations that funneled money on Abramoff's behalf. The groups, including Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, received a cut in return. The funneled money was used to support a series of lobbying efforts. At least $4 million was delivered to campaigns waged by Christian Coalition leader Ralph Reed. Reed's currently running for Georgia's lieutenant governor position. In one email, Abramoff told a colleague Norquist would be willing to fight a tax proposal if the client would become, quote, a major player with Norquist's organization. Abramoff wrote, quote, what's most important, however, is that this matter is kept discreet. We don't want the opponents to think that we are trying to buy the taxpayer movement. Meanwhile, the emails also reveal Norquist was able to arrange a newly disclosed meeting between President Bush and Abramoff's tribal clients in 2002. Previous documents have already shown Bush met an Abramoff client the year before. In the newly disclosed email, Norquist asks Abramoff if his clients could contribute $100,000 to fund a Washington trip of state legislators and tribal leaders who had passed resolutions backed by the White House. Norquist wrote, quote, "When I have funding, I will ask Karl Rove for a date with the president. Karl has already said yes in principle and knows you organized this last time and hope to this year." Norquist delivered on his promise. Abramoff's clients met President Bush for the second time, and the clients subsequently donated to Norquist's ATR. In Denver, one person was killed and another five wounded Sunday when a Safeway employee opened fire inside a company warehouse. The assailant was later killed in a shootout with police. And investment mogul Warren Buffett has announced what's believed to be the largest charitable donation in U.S. history. Buffett says he'll give away 85% of his estimated $44 billion fortune. $31 billion will go to the Gates Foundation, the charity run by Microsoft founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda. However, there is uncertainty over whether the donation will reach the announced total. The money will be given to the Gates Foundation in small annual sums and will require the active involvement at least one of the Gateses in order to continue. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday evening, government officials raided a warehouse in the Liberty City section of Miami and arrested seven men, charging them with conspiring to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago and FBI buildings in five cities. The men are Narcil Batiste, Patrick Abraham, Stanley Fanour, Nadamar Herrera, Burson Augustin, Liglenson Lamorin, and Rothschild Augustine. They range in age from 22 to 32 and were indicted by a federal grand jury in Miami Friday. Five of the men are U.S. citizens. One's a legal immigrant from Haiti. The last is an undocumented immigrant originally from Haiti. The men are charged with two counts of conspiring to support a foreign terrorist organization, one count of conspiring to destroy buildings by use of explosives, and one count of conspiring to wage war against the government. Each faces a maximum sentence of 70 years. This is Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announcing the details of the case at a news conference Friday.
These individuals wish to wage a quote, full ground war against the United States. That quote is from the investigation of these individuals, who also allegedly stated the desire to, quote, kill all the devils we can. They hoped for their attacks to be, quote, just as good or greater than 9/11.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Family and community members have expressed shock at the charges and point out no weapons or explosives were found, nor did investigators document any links to Al-Qaeda. It appears the entire case rests on conversations between Narcil Batiste, the supposed ringleader of the group, and the FBI informant, who was posing as a representative of Al-Qaeda. John Pistol, the FBI's deputy director, described the plan on Friday as, quote, aspirational rather than operational. We're joined right now in Miami by David Marcus and Max Rameau. David Marcus is defense attorney and president of the Miami chapter of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. He's founder of the David Oscar Marcus Law Firm, which focuses on criminal trials and appeals. Max Rameau is with Miami Cop Watch, which is a project of the Center for Pan-African Development. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! David Marcus, let's begin with you. Can you explain exactly what went down on Thursday? What are the charges? What has been shown?
Well, they've alleged in a 13-page indictment that these seven individuals have connections to terrorists and were funding terrorists and were going to be involved in blowing up different places. And as you mentioned, there are no weapons, no connection to Al-Qaeda. You see a lot of scary words in the indictment, like jihad and loyalty oaths and Osama bin Laden. But what we have is the traditional informant going in and talking to a bunch of guys. And what's going to come out in the next couple of weeks is actually what was said, and that's going to be the critical part to the case.
What is the narrative the government has laid out about exactly what happened? Who was the informant? How did they learn about this group of people?
We don't know who the informant is yet. We know from reading the indictment that there were a number of meetings in warehouses and so on in Liberty City, and that those meetings were recorded. We know from reading the indictment as well that there are allegations that there were talks about blowing up the Sears Tower, about the Miami FBI office, about the downtown Justice Building. But again, there was nothing actually done. There was talk. And we've seen in a lot of these cases that talk can sometimes lead to acquittals. So we're going to have to see more than just talk for the government to be able to show their case.
Can you talk about the phrase the government is using, that the plans were aspirational, not operational?
Right. It's interesting because I think even the government is trying to lower expectations in their case because they know that nothing was actually done. I think the most that was done were these guys got some boots from the informant, some military boots. They have to be able to prove that they were able to carry this out, that they were going to do something. And based on the mere words, that's going to be difficult to do. We have to hear what was said on the tapes, how far these meetings got. But based on words and the government's talk as aspirational plans, they may have some tough hurdles to get over.
And can you talk about other cases? Have there been similar ones like this in Miami and Florida?
There have been. The most recent one, of course, was Professor Al Arian, who in Tampa got an acquittal for what the defense was just talking. Now, that case is different in a lot of respects, but I think there are some similarities to be drawn in the way that the professor's defense was, this was just talk, there was nothing more than talk, you're allowed to talk about this kind of stuff, and at the end of the day, he was acquitted of most of the charges. I think that's going to be part of the defense here, in addition to the entrapment and that this was just fantasy on the part of the seven. There have been some other defenses floated around, like that these guys might have just been bad con men trying to get $50,000 and some guns from somebody who came around. Who knows whether the defense is going to be entrapment or that they were conned or that this was just talk. But there are potential defenses being talked about that have been successful in the past.
David Marcus is a defense attorney. Max Rameau is with Miami Cop Watch, which is a project of the Center for Pan-African Development. Max, you are from Liberty City, where the people who have been arrested are from. Can you talk about what you understand has happened, how this has affected the community that these men come from?
Well, Liberty City, where I live at, it's about 20, I live, my home is about 20 blocks from where the raid occurred. I have a lot of friends who are right in that area. The community obviously is very shocked because of the show of force which was there, and shocked because of the incredible and overwhelming news coverage of this. However, as things now are starting to calm down, as the dust is settling, we're taking a closer look at it. And I think a lot of concerns are being raised about the disparate treatment that these men are receiving as compared to what members of other communities receive who might be accused of doing the same thing, or who might have been planning the same thing, or even further along in the plan. So we have a long history of the local law enforcement and the FBI as well attacking and targeting the black community and groups in that community, and we're concerned that this is another example of that.
You say disparate treatment. Can you give us examples of people you're talking about?
Obviously, in the war on drugs, there's a lot more attacks on the black community where less drugs are used than in the white community, but in particular about the issue of terrorism. In addition to Luis Posada, who is a Cuban who is widely considered to be responsible for the 1976 bombing of an airplane with killing 73 people. He is in jail now, but was in Miami walking around freely for many months before he was in jail. And he's jailed on immigration charges, not on bombing charges. Orlando Bosch, who was also a Cuban who held a press conference in April of 2006, essentially confessed on television to his role in that same bombing and killing 73 people, blowing up an airplane. He said that he didn't want to get himself in trouble by saying that he did it, but he essentially confessed to doing it. He lives in Miami right now in a nice big house, and he's not being bothered by anyone. On the day of the raids, that same Thursday, the Miami Herald, which is a local paper, put out a front page article with a former board member of the Cuban American National Foundation by the name of Jose Antonio Lama, came out on the front page and said that the Cuban American National Foundation, which is recognized by the government as a not-for-profit organization had a subcommittee from their board who was responsible and did buy weapons, bought boats, bought helicopters for the purpose of attacking a sovereign country, for attacking Cuba. So these guys were actually terrorists, real live terrorists, and they all live right now free in Miami and not getting arrested. I'm trying to imagine what would happen if a group of black people got together and said, came out on TV and said, we were responsible for blowing up an airplane. What would happen to them? So it looks like there's really a big difference in the treatment. There are some amateur wannabes, terrorists here, allegedly, who are now going to get ready to get run over by this train that is Homeland Security. And there's some real live terrorists who are sitting, living, and being unmolested by the police as we speak. This is really unfair treatment.
Max Ramo, can you talk about the Haitian community in Liberty City and the effect that this has had, Max?
Well, I was born in Haiti myself. The Haitian community has been very upset by this. We're really concerned that this is going to be used as a justification for the continued discriminatory practices against Haitians. Already, Haitians have a difficult time, Haitian refugees have a difficult time getting to the United States. We're concerned that now the government is going to say, we told you all along that we shouldn't have Haitians in here, and this is proof of it. We have a bunch of Haitian terrorists running around here. So we're very concerned that this is going to be used as a justification for discriminatory practices against the Haitian community, both those Haitians trying to come in, and it's going to represent a pretext for cracking down on the Haitian community and the black community in general, but the Haitian community in particular, who live here in South Florida or perhaps other parts of the country. So we really have an interest in making sure that these guys get their due process and that we challenge the official government version of events, because there is a history of lying, of planting evidence, of attacks and disparate treatment on behalf of the government against the black community.
What about the evidence or lack of evidence that was found?
Well, a lot of show has been made about the militaristic boots that they had and the gear and the outfits. Well, it turns out these guys didn't have enough money or enough organization to get these things from themselves. The FBI bought them the boots that we've heard so much about, bought them the military outfits that we've heard so much about. If you look at the indictment, the biggest piece of evidence, it seems to me, that they have is that the group may have taken pictures of a bunch of targets in South Florida. Well, the guys couldn't afford their own cameras, so the federal government bought them the cameras with which they took the pictures. They couldn't get downtown and all the other places by themselves. The federal government rented them the cars that they needed to get downtown in order to take the pictures. So it looks like they really didn't have too much capacity. In addition, right now, the running joke in Liberty City is, you know, in the indictments, if you read the indictments, the men provided the FBI informant with a list of things they needed in order to blow up these buildings. But in the list, they didn't include any explosives or any materials which could be used to make explosives. So now everyone in Liberty City is joking that the guys were going to kick down the FBI building with their new boots. Because they didn't have any devices which could have been used to explode. So this really, really looks pretty thin. In addition, we have concerns. Anyone who's an activist and been to community meetings knows that there's a few people who come into a meeting and make these statements which are a little bit beyond what their capacity is. You know, you go and you talk about a zoning issue and some guy comes in and says, oh, well, we'll just take over the city hall when they're talking about a little small zoning. And you know they have no capacity to do that. So we're concerned that these guys had no capacity to do anything that these things are talking about, that they were led by the hand by this FBI agent. I mean, live in Liberty City, I'm not sure, you know, just judging by Liberty City, not just Liberty City, but most people, I'm not sure these guys knew where the Sears Tower was, much less that it would represent a significant target. So I really wonder who suggested the Sears Tower in the first place, who suggested taking the pictures. Just not all that clear that these guys could have come up with these plots and have carried them out, and it really raises questions again about the other real live terrorists who are living here who are not being arrested.
Max, finally, the issue of when that was first announced, the government said that these were Muslim men. CARE has been quite vocal over the weekend, the Council on Arab-Islamic Relations saying that they are not from their community.
Well, first of all, I don't see that as being a major issue whether they're Muslim or not. I still think that they have a right to a fair trial, and they have a right to the presumption of innocence, and they have a right not to be arrested for thinking things. But with that said, it really raises a lot more questions that the federal government will go out and make these statements that, you know, apparently leak information that these were a bunch of Muslim men when apparently they were not. Muslim men. It raises several questions. First of all, did the government even know if they were Muslim or not? And if they didn't know that these guys were not Muslim, then what else did they not know that they're including in here? And it raises questions that they will come out and outright lie. We've been very concerned about the media coverage also, which has emphasized very, very minute or seemingly insignificant information. Like, these guys like to keep to themselves. These guys wore turbans. Well, what is, you know, I don't understand what the big deal is with some of that, except to the extent that that plays into xenophobic fears and fears about the war on terrorism as framed by the government.
This story came at just the same time as a huge embarrassment to the government, and that is the story in the New York Times about the monitoring of financial records internationally.
Yeah, I really think this could be a case of a weapons of mass distraction, where you have a big embarrassing issue coming out, and right now people are not talking about that, and they're talking about this, and this is not even seemingly all that significant of an arrest. So it really raises question that they didn't have any weapons at the place. It seems to me that the feds would have even thought this out a little bit. They would have at least planted weapons there, but they didn't even go through the trouble of doing that. So it seems that this was thrown out there, thrust out there as a way of distracting people or drawing attention away from another really embarrassing situation, which means that these guys are just props. And I am really offended by that, because I know then that if these guys really are just props, that means that there are the government is spending all kinds of time and resources on people who have don't represent any danger whatsoever to the general society. And there's other people who represent a significant danger to people in the society who are not being tracked, who are not being followed, who are not being arrested. So this is a real, real concern, not only because these guys have rights, but because this is a misappropriation of government money, my money, and everyone else's money as well.
Max Romo, I want to thank you for being with us with Miami Cop Watch, project of the Center for Pan-African Development in Miami, and David Marcus, head of the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. When we come back, we look at immigration. Stay with us.
Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años pasaron ya, en que crucé de mojado y papeles no he arreglado. Sigo siendo un ilegal. Tengo mi esposa y mis hijos, que me los traje muy chicos y se han olvidado ya. Nunca me olvido y no puedo regresar. ¿De qué me sirve el dinero si estoy como prisionero dentro de esta gran nación? Cuando me acuerdo hasta lloro, que aunque la jaula sea de oro.
Los Tigres de Norte here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to immigration. Last week, House Republican leaders announced they'd take the unusual step and hold public hearings across the country on Senate immigration bill that was passed last month. The Senate bill heightens enforcement measures, opens a route to citizenship for at least some undocumented immigrants. But House leaders strongly oppose the bill, instead are pushing their version of an immigration bill that passed in December. That bill focuses strictly on enforcement and would turn undocumented immigrants and anyone who helps them into felons. It was the passage of the House bill that sparked the massive protests and economic boycott in support of immigrant rights that recently took place around the country. The House and Senate now need to negotiate a compromise bill in order to vote on immigration reform, but the decision to hold public hearings over the summer makes it unlikely this will happen anytime soon. Many immigrant advocates contend the GOP decision to hold hearings is a way to spark anti-immigrant sentiment before the November elections. They also point out neither bill adequately addresses the real concerns of the immigrant population in this country. On Friday, I talked to Nativa Lopez here in our studio. He's the national president of the Mexican American Political Association. We talked about the May 1st protests, the significance of that, the boycott. And I began by asking him what happened with the immigration bill last week.
Certainly, it's stalled. And
as a result of the GOP's adamant opposition to any type of legalization program. Although the Senate version, as far as we're concerned, is not much better than the House version. We call it the Corona light effect, Sensenbrenner and the Sensenbrenner light. The Senate version still has many, many enforcement measures similar to Sensenbrenner. In fact, our two senators of California, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, voted for building the wall on the Mexican border, U.S.-Mexico border, sending the National Guard to that border, enhancing the authority of local police to act as agents of the immigration authorities, whittling away or eliminating due process rights for immigrants. So if it was the thinking of Democrats to compromise on the enforcement measures in order to obtain some form of legalization program, and that would satisfy the immigrant community or the immigrant rights movement, et cetera, they were absolutely wrong.
Let's take a step back for a minute when you talk about the Sensenbrenner bill, the House bill. Explain exactly what it does.
The Sensenbrenner bill is essentially an enforcement only legislation, militarizes the border with the border wall, with the National Guard, with enhancing the authority of local police officers to act as agents of the immigration authorities. It penalizes in a criminal manner employers, the worker himself, herself, or anybody that would aid and assist an undocumented immigrant. Not much different, for example, from the 1851 Fugitive Slave Act in the United States that made it a felony offense against anyone that aided or abetted a fugitive slave. The Sensenbrenner bill would essentially do the same thing, would create a felony offense against an employer, against an immigrant worker, or anybody that would assist an individual.
Well, wouldn't it be, for example, against you?
It would be against Hermandad Mexicana, against MAPA, against the church, against the cardinal, against anyone that would assist an individual does not have status.
What has it meant in Los Angeles to have the cardinal behind you? He's been a fierce, outspoken opponent of the legislation.
He's been a fierce opponent of that piece of legislation, but at the same time, he has been a proponent of a compromise measure similar to the Senate version, willing to accept a trade-off of enforcement measures for some form of legalization. And he has indicated he's not satisfied with the legalization program that's offered up in the Senate version. Nevertheless, he still advocates for a compromised approach, for negotiating in the conference committee, thinking that he or the church or the immigrant rights movement would be able to eke out something from that conference committee that could be acceptable to the immigrant rights community.
Are you glad that the bill overall has been tabled now?
Absolutely. Our position has been no bill this year is better than a bad bill.
Do you have confidence in the Democrats? You just said that your two senators have voted for the Senate version that also militarizes the border and supports the wall. If there were a Democratic Congress, let's say, in the next elections, I mean, under Democrats, for example, under Gore and Clinton, you had NAFTA passed. They were behind the Telecommunications Act that passed that led to more media consolidation. Do you have any faith in either party?
Well, I want to remind you of something, Amy. Prior to the Easter recess, we spoke, and I had mentioned that we had tremendous fears that the Democrats would try and cut a deal behind the backs of the immigrant movement that had risen up throughout the United States, and certainly that happened. We were happy, for example, when Senator Harry Reid did not allow the Hagel-Martinez immigration version, legislation version, to come out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. But then he was beat up politically by the National Catholic Conference of Bishops, the Cardinal, the Mayor of Los Angeles, the national leadership of SEIU, the National Council of La Raza, the National Immigration Forum. I'm naming names because these are people that went to Harry Reid and basically beat him up politically and demanded that he allow the Hagel-Martinez bill to see the light of day. And they were confident that some type of a compromise could occur, that a better version could come out of the Senate facing the Sensenbrenner House version. And in fact, what we have today is the worst version of the original Hagel-Martinez in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's a major, major strategic mistake committed by these individuals.
And the key points of Hagel-Martinez?
Well, before that, the point is that prior to the Easter recess, we won. We had defeated the Sensenbrenner bill. We changed the discourse nationally in the debate about immigration reform. The Hagel-Martinez bill essentially mirrors the Sensenbrenner version. Slightly less onerous. For example, instead of a felony offense, it would be a misdemeanor offense against an individual, but nevertheless still criminalize an employer and the immigrant worker. Now, the effect of that is that an immigrant individual who has that misdemeanor defense against him or her would never be able to legalize his status in the United States forever.
But you're talking about Mayor Villaraigosa.
That's correct.
The first Latino mayor of Los Angeles.
Political
ambitions.
Who was spoken
out at the protests.
Right. Well, the first one, let's say that, you know, and in May 1st, there were essentially two major mobilizations. And the second one, where the mayor attended and spoke, was a mobilization that did support a Senate version to face the House version. It's a major strategic mistake. It was essentially a bid on the part of the Democrats to offer up something to the Latinos that they thought would be acceptable, but it has roundly been repudiated by grassroots, base organizations, the immigrant community, families throughout the country. And that will be evident in the next 2 months when the GOP takes their show on the road. We, in turn, will have an immigrants tribunal outside of those hearings to bring forth children, mothers, relatives who have lost family members crossing the border. Well over 4,000 now have lost their lives. The trek across the border that absolutely can be attributed to the policy implemented by Clinton, the Clinton administration, and Senator Dianne Feinstein, the gatekeeper program that was the first wall construction along the border and the further militarization of the border that has led to the loss of over 4,000 lives.
We're talking to Nativa Lopez, national president of the Mexican-American Political Association. What are you going to do in response to this roadshow?
Well, we also are going to have our own tribunal, but the immigrant community will have its tribunal where children, mothers will come forward and give testimony to the indignities and the injustices that they've been subjected and the kind of immigration reform that truly is humane, comprehensive, and allows immigrants to basically play the out of the shadows the role that they do play in building America, the economic contributions that they make, and have that testimony be brought forward to the American people outside of the halls where the GOP would conduct their hearings in California, Arizona, and Texas.
Your response to National Guard being brought to the border?
Further militarization of the border. It's going to lead to more deaths. It's going to lead to eventual violence along the border. It's a great indicator that the enforcement measure approach is a short-term stopgap approach that will only lead to further violence along the border and not resolve the tremendous immigration dynamic and labor needs that we still have in this country.
The Republicans in Congress are trying to delay reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. What is the significance of this?
Again, it's an incredible hypocrisy. The same day that House Member Hastert talked about taking the GOP show on the road, opposed and defeated the increase of the minimum wage and delayed the reauthorization of the Civil Rights Act. It shows an incredible hypocrisy on the one hand that these individuals talk about supporting native-born workers, solidifying the national workforce before we allow immigrants to come into the United States, but then doing not only little, but opposing any measure that would strengthen working people in the United States by increasing the minimum wage and by allowing them to participate legally and unimpededly
in the political process by reauthorizing the Civil Rights Act. And one of the sticking points, for example, in the Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, is the obligation of the federal government to assure that non-English speaking individuals can participate in an unimpeded manner in the political process by having ballots in languages other than English. Only 5% in a given jurisdiction, for example, that don't speak English, that jurisdiction should provide a voting material in the language of that 5%. And this is sticking in the craw of these individuals in the House, the Republicans, that absolutely are opposed to any measure that would recognize a language other than English for voting purposes.
Speaking of voting, can you comment on the Mexican elections? You're head of MAPA, the Mexican American Political Association.
Right.
They're coming up on July 2nd.
Well, I think we're going to have a different type of president after July 2nd in Mexico. I predict that Manuel López Obrador will be the new president of Mexico, but I don't predict that that's going to lead to any great radical change in the economic political direction of Mexico. Mr. López Obrador is more of a center-left social democrat of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt type, although he's being painted as a socialist or a Hugo Chavez clone.
Thanks
that's
to
absolutely
Dick
not.
Morris, right? Dick
that's
Morris,
great.
Who is President Clinton's PR man, has gone down to intervene in the elections, and they're showing images of López Obrador next to Hugo Chavez.
Right. That's sad, essentially, because we have an individual that will strengthen, actually, national capital, national Mexican capital, and national industries vis-a-vis U.S. Capital and transnational capital that seeks to gobble up the economy of Mexico and use it to the interests of not the Mexican people. So he's really a person that will attempt to strengthen the Mexican economy, Mexican capital, protect industries, again, strengthen the state, look for a better redistribution of wealth in Mexico. Smart in that sense, because he knows that there's going to be a revolution in Mexico. And actually, that flies in the face of what the Republicans want to do here in militarizing the border, building the wall, so they don't allow 500,000 immigrants coming through the southern border into the United States. What are those people going to do? They want to eat. And so essentially, the GOP is setting up a situation, a dynamic that will only lead to further social disorder or civil strife and possible social revolution in Mexico or other southern countries.
So, Nativa Lopez, putting it in this broader context, what is the answer?
Well, the answer is to recognize that individuals are coming to the United States out of economic necessity. There's a huge demand for their labor. They should be offered legal status as a result of the contributions that they seek to make and that we want them to make because of the demand for their labor. And that's a fair trade-off. You know, these GOP guys are always talking about, and even Democrats talking about fair trade. Well, we say for the immigrant community, the fair trade is if I'm going to come up here and make labor contributions and produce value and wealth for the great United States, a fair trade is legal status.
Blanket amnesty.
Well, we don't call it amnesty. We call it essentially a fair trade, a legalization for those individuals that are willing to create wealth, value for the United States. They should be accorded legal status and their families as well.
Guest worker programs?
We're absolutely opposed to guest worker programs. They seek to perpetuate servitude. There's no reason in the world why a person should be contract labor in the United States. That program actually exists in the United States. There's something like 40 to 60 individuals working under a current program that would be expanded under the Senate version of the immigration bill. And we think that truly does undermine native labor. Those workers should be accorded legal status. And it's shameful that there are some unions like the International, the SEIU, the United Farm Workers, Unite Here. Those particular unions, for example, support a guest worker program. They are living under some illusion that they will be able to obtain contracts to represent these workers and receive dues monies from those members to fill the coffers of those unions. We think that that's a strategic mistake on the part of those unions to do that, and we do support the position of the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, United Food and Commercial Workers, and many other unions that are absolutely opposed to any form of contract temporary labor. Those workers are going to be here. They should be accorded legal status, paid a fair wage. We should increase the minimum federal minimum wage and the state minimum wage throughout the United States so that immigrant workers are not put in a position to compete against native workers of the United States.
And finally, this idea of the larger context of trade agreements in the world. How does that weigh in on immigration reform?
Our current immigration situation is globalization coming home to roost. We can't get away from it. We can build the China Wall, the Berlin Wall along the border. We are not going to resolve the immigration situation by enforcement measures because it's now a globalized situation. And it's happening throughout the world. This dynamic that we're facing today is happening in Europe. It's happening in other countries, other sections of the world. So we need to recognize that workers are human beings. They're creating value. They're creating important value for our country, and they should be accorded legal status. If we regularize the border in such a way that those workers that are coming are accorded status, they're in our database. We'll know who they are. They'll be given identification papers. They'll be given working papers. It's a question of national security. Wouldn't one think that by knowing everybody that's coming across and documenting them at the border, that we would be safer than not knowing who's coming across the border?
So how would it work? Would anyone be able to come over the border? It would be an open border.
Essentially, we have a situation where the border is open today. Close to 1 million workers are coming into the United States from different sections. In any case, we have a more militarized border today than ever in the history of the United States. Nevertheless, from Mexico alone, something like 500,000 workers are coming through. And that's because of the interrelatedness of our economy. So if those workers are coming anyway, let them sign up in port of entry, and they will absolutely know who they are. But the other thing is that when you create a wall and you capture people in the confines of the United States where they now fear returning to their country of origin because it is so difficult to return, they essentially stay here. The initial desire of most workers are to be here on a temporary basis, so we have allowed them to be here in such a manner, they'll return to their country of origin to be with their family, to solidify their economy at home, instead of bringing the family into the United States for fear that their repeated returns and attempts to return to the United States will be impeded or even result in a loss of life.
Are more major immigration protests planned?
Absolutely. Labor Day this year, September 4th, will be a historic difference than what it's been in the past, similar to what we observed on May Day of this year. We will be joining with labor unions throughout the United States to organize major mega marches demanding fairness and the rights for immigrants, but as one with the labor movement in the United States, because the movement of the immigrants in the United States can only be solidified to the measure that labor generally is solidified.
Nativo Lopez, president of the Mexican-American Political Association based in Los Angeles, joined us in our Firehouse studio on Friday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, the World Cup with sports writer Dave Zirin. Stay with us.
De lejos esta tierra, fue porque había escuchado la promesa. aquí yo encontraría la manera para poder vivir.
I was Amatli Mihente here on Democracy Now! And democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 4 weeks, 32 countries, 64 matches. 1 billion viewers. The World Cup. It's the most watched sporting event on the planet. Once every 4 years, the world comes to a standstill to watch countries compete in what's known as the beautiful game, football, or soccer, as it's called in the United States. Nearly every nation in the world competes to play in the World Cup. Only 32 qualify. Just the honor of making it to the tournament is tremendous. It can even help to stop war. That's right, in the Ivory Coast this year, warring sides called a temporary truce to a bloody 4-year civil conflict when the national team qualified for their first ever World Cup. In Argentina, with so many kids staying home to watch the games, teachers showed the games at school and made the World Cup part of the curriculum in geography and other issues. This year's tournament is being held in Germany, and the competition is well underway. Only 12 countries remain in the running. The United States is not one of them. They were eliminated in the first round by Ghana, which is competing in its first ever World Cup. Dave Zirin joins us now. He writes the weekly column Edge of Sports, a regular contributor to The Nation, author of the book What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dave.
Great to be here, Amy.
Talk about the significance of these games.
Oh, incredibly significant. And it's been particularly significant here in the United States because normally to be a soccer fan in the United States is to be in the witness protection program of sports. I mean, you are watching these games in the dark of night, undercover, communicating over email lists about your favorite players. But this is really the time for soccer to take center stage. And even though one may not see it take center stage on ESPN, anybody who goes to any of the neighborhood bars in your local city know that this has the pulse of the neighborhood. I mean, in Washington, D.C., where I'm from, you go down to U Street where they have the Eritrean or Ethiopian bars. I mean, they are just buzzing. You go to the Irish pubs on Connecticut Avenue. You can hear the cheers in the streets. And especially in Adams Morgan, where there's a wonderful place called the Ghana Cafe. I mean, when Ghana beat the United States, I mean, you would have thought you were in Accra because people were pouring out into the streets, singing songs, waving flags. And that's the aspect of the World Cup that I think people find so appealing.
What about the significance of that, Ghana beating the United States?
Oh, it's tremendously significant. I mean, first and foremost, because the United States was very favored going into this tournament. They made the quarterfinals 4 years ago. And Ghana, as you mentioned, this was their first ever World Cup. And very few people predicted that Ghana would make it to this point. And what's so exciting about the Ghanaian team is that they seem to be fulfilling the prophecy of the great Pelé, who predicted almost 30 years ago that by the year 2000, an African team would win the World Cup. That hasn't happened yet, but to see Ghana playing with such flair and beauty and excitement really has people excited about the future of soccer in Africa.
In one of your pieces, you describe the commentators and the
yes.
people from Ghana who were watching in the Ghana Cafe, their
yes.
response to them.
Oh, I'm furious about the commentators. I mean, first and foremost, because to watch the game, you would think that it was the United States versus some team. And there was just very little mention of the Ghanaian players, of what the Ghanaian players were doing. Everything was in relation to the United States, and that just brought them no end of frustration. The other thing that was very frustrating for the people at the Ghana Cafe was just very little mention of the fact that the Ghanaian players largely don't get to play in Europe at the top leagues. So they don't get to play in the off years against the best players and really hone their abilities. Most of them play in leagues in Africa or in the Middle East. And that frustrated them to no end because when Ghana was beating the U.S., one of the commentators said, well, that's because so many of these Ghanaian players are now playing in Europe. They've really been able to hone their skills. When you're talking about literally one Ghanaian player who plays in the top leagues in Western Europe. So the Ghanaian fans, who are just incredibly savvy and have forgotten more about soccer than the commentators they have on the air, just throw up their hands and just like, are you kidding me? What is this person talking about? Because there is that kind of pride in what Ghana is being able to accomplish. And it's worth saying that it's a continent-wide pride. It wasn't all Ghanaians in the Ghana Cafe. It was people from Ethiopia, Eritrea, South Africa, Namibia. I mean, it really was this sense of a continent unity that I think speaks to the best angels of our nature with regards to sports.
Dave Zirin, talk about Iran.
Absolutely. Well, Iran was part of the World Cup. They were the Middle Eastern champions this year, and there was a push to keep them from playing in the World Cup because of the nuclear controversy that's been going on there, because of the desire for a nuclear enrichment program led by President Ahmadinejad. And the European Union, they passed a resolution to try to keep Iran out of the World Cup. One of the leaders of the EU suggested that they get Bahrain, who came in second, to play in the World Cup, because they said, if we get Bahrain here, then people won't think it's an attack against the Muslim world. It'll show how generous we are, that we actually want Bahrain to play, which is just an idiotic head-scratching concept. In the United States, this happened as well when Senator John McCain, the maverick of Bob Jones University, attempted to get a bill passed through the Senate that would call for FIFA, that's the governing soccer body, from keeping Iran from playing in the World Cup. I mean, it was a transparent effort to try to use the current geopolitical situation as a club to keep Iran out of the World Cup. And it's something that failed, which is a very good thing.
Racism at the game?
Oh, my goodness. Well, in the lead up to the Cup, there it was a continent-wide controversy throughout Europe about racism at the top levels of soccer. And this is accompanied in Europe issues around immigration, asylum, anti-Muslim sentiment. And with that, you've seen a resurgence of just some absolutely awful spectacles, like star African players who play in the European leagues. Every time their foot would touch the ball, fans would make ape noises or monkey noises. Fans would be throwing... I actually don't even like calling them fans, but people in the stands would be throwing banana peels at them, peanuts at them, and it got so bad that a star player named Samuel Eto'o, who's from Cameroon and plays for Barcelona, he literally started to walk off the field and said, I'm not going to play anymore. And it took players from both teams to get together to quiet the fans down, to eject fans. Another player named Mark Zorro, who plays for a top Italian club who's from Africa, he picked up the ball and started to just walk off the field holding the ball. Not allowed to touch the ball with your hand, so he was pretty mad. He was ready to walk away. I mean, it's an absolutely horrible thing. One of the African players was quoted anonymously saying that in Europe we're treated as worse than dogs. And it got some play here in the U.S. when a U.S. player of African descent named DeMarcus Beasley, he described the situation and said, every time my foot touches the ball, you know, I feel like I'm in just some horrible, racist, anachronistic film, you know, of some kind. And this is the sort of thing that soccer is facing right now.
But it hasn't happened as much at the World Cup.
No, and it hasn't happened. We should be very clear about this, that the reason why it's happened less at the World Cup, despite some little outbursts by little neo-Nazi fringe groups trying to organize rallies or whatnot, is because of the organization of players and fans themselves. There's a group called FARE, F-A-R-E, that's Footballers Against Racism that have been organizing to keep the racists out. There's a star player from France of African descent named Thierry Henry, who started a campaign called Stand Up, Speak Up, which is an amazing campaign. He actually pressured his sponsor, Nike. You don't usually think of Nike when you think of the anti-racist vanguard in the world, but he's pressured Nike to actually produce these black and white armbands to sell that fans could wear in solidarity with anti-racism. They've sold over 5 million.
We only have 30 seconds, but American soccer player Eddie Johnson,
yes,
just a few days went before the games to Ramstein Air Base in,
yes,
Germany and said, we're here for a war.
Yes. I mean, there's something about the sporting DNA of the United States that seems to import war into these games. And Eddie Johnson, he's a very young man. He apologized for saying it, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt as a 21-year-old. But I got to tell you, people in the Ivory Coast who know what war is really like know we shouldn't be playing these games by conflating sports and war.
Dave Zirin, I want to thank you very much for being with us. He's author of the book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. That does it for today's broadcast. You can go to our website to get our show at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Bokadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Also thanks to Uri Galad, Angela Alston, Megan Whitney, Samantha Chamblee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!